Welcome to Holden Village's Theological Conference, sponsored by the Lutheran Educational Network and Support. This evening's session is a fireside chat with speakers Dr. Stortz, Dr. Cox, and Chaplain Metcalf. Let's listen in.
This is a very informal kind of discussion, time for you to ask questions of Dr. Stortz. So, who wants to start?
Start. I'm going to be second.
Okay.
Marty, you said that you had just started on this venture with spirituality in the Lutheran tradition. What caused you to get interested in it? What motivated you?
Well, it's again the number of students coming to me and talking about the need for spiritual. You know, how can I need some discernment, I want some spiritual direction. And we send them to the Catholics. You know, I teach in a consortium of nine ecumenicals, of nine other seminaries. We've got Jesuits, Dominicans, Franciscans, we've got Presbyterians and Baptists, we've got Episcopalians, we've got Unitarians, and we've got a generic Protestant seminary. So those are the nine seminaries that collaborate together. And we work very closely, running a common doctoral program. We also do a lot of collaboration on the MDiv level and a Master's of Religious Studies level. And I got tired of sending people to the Catholics. And I began to wonder, well, you know, here's a guy. Luther came out of an Augustinian monastery. He came out of, he was part of the observant part of the Augustinian tradition in the 16th century. So that the observant types were more by the book, you know, rigid types. That certainly was part of his formation. Doesn't he have any way of transmitting that to? I mean, did he disappear that with the move out of the monastery or not? And you start digging around and stuff, because a lot of people are writing on spirituality today. And you find that, you know, other people are trying to track Luther's understanding of spirituality. How did Luther think about this? What did he do with it? And then you begin finding Luther's stuff. And the text I was talking about today is in the American edition. It's in volume 43, A Simple Letter to a Simple Guy Who Wanted a How-To Book on Prayer. And it's really fascinating what resources are out there. I was talking with Anne, Lynn. I was talking with Lynn. There's a long tradition in the history of spirituality of letters of spiritual direction. You see this with Jerome and his friends, Melania. You see this with Teresa and John of the Cross. You see this with Pelagius and Demetrius. People talking to each other, trying to engage in spiritual direction, really through the mail. You couldn't pick up a telephone or use a fax machine or email somebody, and you often couldn't get together face to face, particularly when it's male and female. So you get a lot of it. You can read these letters of spiritual direction. When I think about Luther's correspondence, and he wrote letters to everybody, priests, who wanted to talk about leaving and marrying, nuns who wanted to marry, princes who wanted to know how to conduct their lives. Luther's letters are really in that tradition of letters of spiritual direction. Well, this is what Scripture says. This is your situation. Let's pray about this. This is what you should be praying for. Let's think about how this would work out. So I think there's a lot. I think there's a lot there that when you look at it in terms of Luther's Augustinian heritage, his prior life as an Augustinian monk, makes a lot of sense to see it in terms of the classical traditions of spirituality. So it just seemed like the thing to do. And then in part it's my own schizophrenia. I mean, when I thought about having a conversation with a Sulpician priest while I was in a Camaldolese monastery doing a Jesuit retreat that was being directed by a Paulist father, and I'm a Lutheran, you begin to wonder, what are you doing, really? What are you doing? And what resources does my own tradition have that could answer some of these burning questions, really. If I had to add one other piece of this, it is also my conviction, having worked as a Lutheran ethicist, that so much of Luther's moral thinking is configured by his understanding of God. That our relationship in the world is determined by our relationship to God. That somehow that vertical relationship, I don't like to do the vertical horizontal here, but one's relationship to God has a lot to say about who and how we are in the world. And so, how is that relationship shaped by prayer? So that's a long answer to a simple question.
Are you acquainted with RCIA methodology?
No. Can you tell me
something? Well, this is the rite of Christian initiation for adults out of their own tradition. They're picking this up as a process for membership or leading up to baptism, depending on whether the person's been baptized before. Mystagogy is the part of spiritual formation. It's really the last part. It's a four-tiered kind of thing. But it's the difference there is nobody's going to have your kind of experience that you're talking about in that very structured setting. But this is really geared for congregational involvement. It's in effect a well thought out sponsored program. And it reflects the church prior to Constantine.
I know that it's happening, but I don't know the structure of it at all. Do you think there are resources there for us?
Yes. Well, the Churchill Training Publications out of Chicago do a lot of things with that.
Give us the title.
What, RCIA?
Yeah.
Rite of Christian Initiation of Adults.
Rite of the Christian Initiation of Adults.
Yeah, Rite for Christian Initiation.
Yeah.
It began as a rite, but it's much larger.
Is it a basic catechesis program? As I've looked at it,
I would say it's much more than a catechesis program. Depending on how widely you want to describe
define
it.
Now. Catechesis.
But certainly it's talking about what you're talking about, spiritual formation. And it's perhaps not as rigid in the sense of saying morning and evening, that kind of thing so much. It leans more heavily upon people who are trained to be sponsors in the congregation, who relate one-on-one, sort of Stephen ministry kind of thing in that regard, to people who are newly involved in the faith or in a congregation. And they mutually commit to each other. It's a very aggressive kind of a program, but it takes seriously the entrance into the Christian faith or congregation. It's a two-year event. And baptism does not happen willy-nilly for those who have not been baptized. But the formation continues after baptism for a year. And presumably, I guess it could be more, but it's a two-year commitment.
You know, we were talking so much about lifelong learning for the clergy. This is really lifelong catechesis, broadly defined, for the whole people of God, which is not a bad way to go. Not a bad way to go. And when Luther talks about instruction as sort of the first tier, I think he's reminding us of that. You know, you think you did this, you think you learned all this yesterday, but you may need to learn it again today.
And just incidentally, this letter to Peter the Barber would be, if you don't have that whole ponderous set of Luther works, it's also in Dobersen's, which is in prayer book. So that he wants already access to it.
That's called a ministry of prayer.
Then whatever it is.
It's in volume 43 of Luther's works, if you have access to that. And it is really very helpful. I mean, I was simply summarizing it mostly today, but it really is helpful.
Elmer had it.
Well, yeah.
What do you see as particularly Lutheran about what you gave us this morning?
It's interesting. I think what's particularly Lutheran about it is that it's given to his barber. And I think that's a first particularly Lutheran emphasis. And then I think the significance of that is that there's a lot from the classical traditions and spirituality there. There's sort of a centering prayer. There's the regularity of practice. There's the sort of preparation for prayer, the warming of the heart. But it's directed to his barber. And I think it's the effect of that. I think there may be a lot of continuities with the tradition that Luther was using, Luther was coming out of. I think there may be a lot of continuities, but it's kind of like breaking down the walls of the monastery and suggesting that this is applicable to a barber, a housewife, a nurse, a healthcare professional. I think, too, the thing that is fascinating is Luther's using the Ten Commandments centrally in this. And the Ten Commandments in the uses of medieval piety, the thou shalt commandments were seen to apply only to the clerical offices. The thou shalt not commandments were for us, a laity crowd, or for me as a lay person. I was only expected to do, it's a minimalist morality, and it's for those in religious life and for the priests that the thou shalt commandments were to apply, and the whole roster of the Beatitudes. So there was really a two-story morality. For Luther to not only take the Ten Commandments and give them to his barber and say, this applies to you, not just to the clergy, but all of it applies to you, really puts the screws on Christian morality in a very, very interesting way, and Christian spirituality in a very, very interesting way.
That's helpful.
And plus I think, too, you know, as I'm thinking about the traditions he was coming out of, certainly the Benedictine traditions prayed through the Psalter in a week. And, you know, they spent a lot of time praying through the Psalter in a week. And here's a guy who doesn't have that kind of time. So you give him something familiar and something short. Luther has this wonderful piece in his letter to Master Peter where he says, you know, the mind is such a wonderful thing. The mind is such a wonderful thing. Actually, you might find yourself doing all four levels simultaneously. Reading this as instruction, and then as prayer, and as thanksgiving, and confession, you might be able to do all of this simultaneously. But don't feel like you have to go through it all. Listen for the Spirit. Listen for the teaching of the Spirit. And let the Spirit be your preacher here. So I find that a very, very interesting move. Yeah.
How would one talk about this process of spirituality when one looks across age levels?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then related to that is the question of the development of the person at whatever age.
Mm-hmm.
How does it change?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do we need to take those dimensions into account when we try to establish atmospheres of spirituality or techniques of spirituality?
Yeah. That's a really interesting question, John. It seems to me that for the very young children, maybe instruction would be perhaps the most an important part. I mean, they need to know the resources, but not only instruction. I mean, that can be a barrier to opening this up for thanksgiving and for praise and for confession. I don't know. It is an interesting question, though, how this would be used in the whole of the Christian life.
I wondered whether we need to dialogue with psychologists about human development and to see how best to tie that in. If we just toss it out as something that is good for everybody, and don't take into account the various points at which they are in their own spiritual growth and development and the various levels at which they are, psychologically, physically, socially, etc. Is there a difference? Does one have to take that into account or what?
Oh, sure. See, I think, you know, I was talking with Bob Winkle. He's not here, so
he's back there.
He's there. Okay. You had sort of suggested this as one spoke in a wheel. And I thought a lot about that, and I thought, yeah, that really has to be, you know, that this sort of individual life of prayer has to be nurtured by a corporate worship in a congregation and the proclamation of the word, the administration of the sacraments, certainly. And you mentioned also Bible study as being a key part of this. I wonder if a part of this isn't also a sort of, you know, in Sunday school, however that is conducted, and maybe small group work. Because whenever there is individual prayer, that needs to be counterweighted with a kind of corporate discernment, whether that's with one other person or a small group. I mean, you need a group to be accountable to. You need a group to hold to accountability. There's reflexive accountability. And you also need someone to test what you're finding out in prayer. Well, this is what I'm learning, this is what I'm feeling. And somebody who would say, oh, you're being too hard on yourself, or oh, you're not being hard enough on yourself. Or, well, why don't you worry a little bit about the first table of the commandments? You're so focused on what these relationships to the neighbor think about your relationship to God. I mean, Luther's spirituality is very much structured by the Ten Commandments, one's relationship to God, which then orders and structures one's relationship to family and the neighbor. It's really quite fascinating. Yeah.
Marty, I think it's also, I'm seeing the ties in sense of Luther putting it back in the home, and what Tim was talking about, you know, the pastors in the future may have to be more like rabbis and encourage... maybe the family is the place, at some place where that communal discernment is happening also.
That's a really fascinating point, because I think when kids are really grasped by the Christian message is when they see how much it means to their parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, you
and
can
the
get
catechism has the same, all of those points in them already, and is to be taught by the parents to the children.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I was grabbed by Tim's idea about, you know, sort of witnesses in a liturgical structure, witnesses to, this is what being Christian means to me. Now that would be wonderful for me to hear in my congregation why we're all there. You know, why are we here? What does it really mean for you? But it would be outstanding if children could hear their parents talk about this. And that in a way suggests a smaller setting, perhaps, but an intergenerational setting. You know, I think too often our Christian education is segregated chronologically, and possibly for some good reasons, but also at some cost.
Well, I know several clergy that I've talked with who insist that the parents be involved in confirmation instruction by activities that occur at home, which I think fits into what you say, which is not easy to do today. But and I don't know how successful many of them are. I know a couple have been very successful.
Do you think that this is a good thing for all Lutheran pastors to do? Do you think it's necessary for us all to do that?
You tell me.
Well, I'm wondering just how you were recommending it in your presentation. My sense is that if you need it, fine. Mm-hmm. For me, this kind of hard work about spirituality is for people who just can't relax. It's free. Mm-hmm. It's there. Take it. Live it. Mm-hmm. Have it all the time. Well, what's the hard work all about? That's what I don't understand. Mm-hmm. What's missing that you need to get? I'm not sure. I can understand students coming to you and saying, I want more.
But only some students.
I wasn't making any prescriptive comments about this. Was I? Did you hear me?
No, I said you weren't.
Yeah, I was just sort of presenting this, I think, as a resource. And, you know, kind of running it up the flagpole and seeing what kind of reaction it would get. I have no program for congregational use. My only concern is that I hear a lot of people out there calling for this, not only my students, but also laity. I think as we've done our surveys of need, surveys for what people seem to want in the Pacific Northwest, actually spirituality and spiritual formation comes out pretty high on the list. And is that right, John?
Yeah.
You want to see more about that? Or?
But are we giving them the right thing by sending them to the monks?
Well, that's my question, and I wonder if we are. I want to, before we do, or as we do in addition, I want people to know what the resources in our own tradition are. And this strikes me as an interesting resource, both its structure and its flexibility, the use of things that are very familiar, the sense that it isn't just an individual thing, that you are praying into the communion of saints. And I think we, as Lutheran congregations, would probably want to see that this disciplined devotional life, structure ways for that to feed back into the life of a congregation, the corporate life of a congregation. Now, I'm not sure this is where I think your question is interesting. I'm not sure this isn't already happening in certain ways. I think of the Lydia circles, the Dorcas circles, the Mary and Martha circles. These are people who are kind of already doing some sort of intercessory prayer for others. They're the people who organize the funeral stuff, the, you know, receptions after funerals, and go the visiting teams and stuff like that. And a lot of these groups structure their ministries around Bible study and prayer. And so in a way it's already happening.
I'm kind of afraid that the high incidence of responses to some survey about what they need reflect an inadequate view of what spirituality is about anyway.
Talk about your fear.
They need to feel it more, need to be more holy somehow, to have it occupy their mind more than it is, and to be more at peace with it all. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me a better answer might be to have them related to their everyday life rather than removing them from everyday life somehow, and have it be there all the time, rather than separate. So I'd rather see an integrated kind of spirituality than set apart.
I think the integration thing that you're talking about is exactly what they're looking for. The business person, for example, that wants a prayer group. What is that business man or businesswoman looking for? Looking for some kind of relationship in which they can talk about the problems they have in the business community in which they live. And that's...
Do you find that by repetition of the Lord's Prayer? Or the Ten Commandments or anything else? I mean, repetition. Which is what's being recommended. And other disciplines and hard work. It seems to me that these down-to-earth interpretation and relation of spirit to everyday reality.
Think about it this way. I mean, let me just argue with you for a minute here, because it's not repetition, is it? It's not mere repetition.
Oh, I thought he was saying pray it four times. Right?
No. He's saying pray it four times in this way.
Yeah.
Pray it. Hear it for instruction. Hear it first for instruction. Well, I mean, you know, when I you shall have no other gods before me, I'm tempted to think about all of my own devious patterns of idolatry. I can be quite specific, I won't tonight, but it's there. And I think I'm challenged to be, I'm instructed against idolatry in that. And then I'm counseled to offer thanksgiving and praise to a God who has, you know, who is God alone. And I give thanks for that. I give thanks for the many blessings this God of all things, has placed in my life. And I don't mean blessings in a generic sense. I'm challenged there to name the blessings in a very, very concrete way and thank God for them. And then thirdly, this confession, which follows the thanksgiving, challenges me, I think, to do exactly what Bruce Hartung was talking about last night, challenges me to identify the ways in which my appearance is, I make my presentation so much different from who it is that I really am. That I'm really challenged to address that gap before God and probably eventually before other people in my prayer group or something like that. And finally, I make a prayer. So I think the way that this could be used can be quite amazing, quite specific, and quite integrated. Now maybe it has to be. I think one. Let me just roll on here. I think one hub, another spoke in the wheel, is the mutual conversation and consolation of the brothers and sisters. How to figure that in a way that doesn't just let me tell all this to God and not have to try to live it out in my life. I need some accountability to somebody or some other bodies on this. But it strikes me that this has powerful integrative potential. And it's not, you know, we're not flipping around for exotica, spiritual exotica. There's a lot of spiritual exotica out there, which is pretty dangerous. But see, this has the potential to be not very comfortable, it seems to me. Not very comfortable at all. And I don't get further, because the next day I have to listen to the same old stuff and be instructed and give thanks and acknowledge that I'm a sinful person and offer God prayer. Now that's not a lot of progress. I think Luther, I agree, Luther was very worried about people wandering around thinking they could move up notches in the ladder to perfection. He's very, very concerned about that. Therefore the confession. Therefore the need for instruction. Therefore the need for prayer. Again, this is Lutheran. But are we, I interrupted you. No, I interrupted you. It's great if, you know, you want to.
I think a lot of what David was saying, isn't there a spirituality that needs to be stressed where we see God in life and everything, mm-hmm. so that we see it in the world we live in, the people we work with, and mm-hmm. so that kind of spirituality, which doesn't necessarily bring you into some routine that you go over, but you learn to mm-hmm. to acknowledge life mm-hmm. and God in the midst of it. Mm-hmm. In all relationships and the creation and, mm-hmm. and everything. I think that to me that's the kind of spirituality I'd like to see stressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I remember you referring to was Luther's comment about even when you are sweeping the floor
yeah.
and doing those things. I think that
is
part of
yeah.
the whole scheme of things here.
Yeah, he was saying, and he's quoting Jerome, St. Jerome at this point. Probably Luther did also, but the one who works faithfully prays twice. So there is the sense of which the works of one's vocation fit desperately into all of this. And I think for, you know, if you look at the catechism and Luther's explanation to the catechism, you're constantly looking at the neighbor. You're constantly staring at the face of the neighbor. It's so prominent in the way Luther understands these things. And you're constantly, as you're thinking about the creed, you're thinking about the creator of all things, the redeemer of all things, the one who breathes life through all things living. So I think it's there. But I see your concern. I mean, we need simultaneously the ability to see God through all things and see God behind all things and see God in all things working. I think that ability, that vision is improved if we're in touch with God on a rather regular basis.
I think
think there's something to the repetition, though, because I think of the communities that pray the Psalter, like, and whatever your situation in life, you know, you may not know what psalm you're going to reach. It might be a rejoicing one, and it might be a, you know, a vindictive one, or it might be a mourning one, or whatever. And you might be in a joyous space and have to pray a mourning one, and you see things differently. Or you may be mourning and have to do a celebration song because of the repetition and just where you're falling. And I think we have lost the sense of that repetition as being a way to open up our eyes to, at all times, God in all things and God present at all times. I think it's nice to say that, but how many of us actually do it? I mean, we walk around and half the time we're thinking about our own concerns, and we maybe occasionally will say, oh yeah, I'm going to thank God for this. Yeah, this really struck me. I'm going to thank Him. But if you're in a pattern and you're doing it, you're forced, no matter what your situation in life, to stop and think and hear the same words again, but maybe in a different way because you're in a different situation. I don't know.
It's interesting. Kathleen Norris, who writes about spending a lot of time at this Benedictine monastery where the whole Psalter was prayed in a week, she said the nuns would tell her that they began to understand their lives through the Psalms, that a mother was dying words of a psalm, as pants the heart for a living stream, so longs my soul for you, O God. So in a way, they weren't casting about for language to understand their experiences. They had the language. And scripture was a way of understanding what was happening to them. And it's wonderful because that does cut against the tyranny of experience. You're depending on the experience of someone else and on the experience of a tradition that has held this text up and said, this might make a lot of sense. This might make a lot of sense someday. Hang on to this. You're trusting in the wisdom of a tradition to say, yeah, you guys were right, or you people were right. This has helped me. This has sustained me. It's living in a story-shaped world.
Question of curiosity, you had said that this priest had told you that they had come to the conclusion that they couldn't take these Lutherans anymore and train them in spirituality because they had to, what, sort of attend to their own?
They had, it was a matter of volume. It was a matter of volume.
Oh, okay.
And I think that probably wasn't clear in my remarks because you're the second person who's asked me about that. But it was a sheer volume that, and he felt bad about it. He felt really bad about it, but he said, you know, our primary responsibility here is to our novices. And, you know, we can't be training all of your seminarians, doing spiritual direction for all your seminarians. You know, God, I wish to God that we had the resources to do that, but we don't have the resources to do it, and our primary responsibilities lie elsewhere. So it was interesting. I mean, in a way, he was speaking real sadness and sorrow, but it was also a nudge, like, gosh, and what? Why aren't we taking care of our own? And so then you know, as somebody involved, you kind of begin looking. But you know, I try to imagine training my faculty, and it kind of blows my mind. Not training my faculty, I mean, I wouldn't presume to do that, but, you know, sort of suggesting this as a possible resource for our students. Oh, I have a really good idea about the advisory system here. We will not simply function as academic advisors, but also spiritual directors. Whoa, that just collapses my brain.
Why didn't that?
Well, it's interesting.
What's so intimidating about being a spiritual director?
Maybe your story should fall in at this point.
Sure. When I was at Lutheran Northwestern, I sat on the Academic Affairs Committee. I was telling Marty this story. And that was back in like 84, I think. And with the number of students we were asking, we need some spiritual direction. We need some people to help us pray. We need some people to help us look and think and feel about what's going on and integrate it. And we need some people to teach us how to read the Bible and know the Bible and be friends with the Bible. And we just continued to meet this wall of resistance and real strong resistance in the faculty. And finally I asked, you know, what do you hear when I ask about that, when I ask about spirituality or spiritual direction? What is it that you have in your mind? And one of the professors, it was Dan Simonson, talked about when he was growing up and the family pattern that they had, the family habit that they had of reading scriptures and praying every day, and how for him that was oppressive because he wasn't allowed to question or to wrestle with it. And when he ran into the historical critical method, that for him was freedom because he could study and wrestle and question and bring his mind into relation with the text and not just kind of be obedient and, you know, some of the old Icelandic piety, you know. And so for him to think about bringing these adult students under the discipline of prayer and devotional reading again, he thought back to his sort of what felt like a very oppressive, rigid pattern. Only we were coming from the next generation of Christians who hadn't grown up with that closeness and hadn't grown up really with people teaching us to pray dearly. And we were starving because we had never been invited into that, into friendship with the Bible, you know, and into that closeness. And they didn't know how to do it because they had never had that experience either, but they were afraid that that meant going back to rigidness.
So they thought that your request was evidence of a refreshing pietism that they've been trying to stamp out for quite some time.
Yeah. Exactly.
Straighten them up.
What?
Straighten them up.
Yeah. But I think this would be. I think you're. Why not? You're quite right. Why not? I mean, that is something, and for most of the Roman Catholic schools, all the faculty do direction, do spiritual direction. But it's they work in very conscious traditions, and the students work in very, very self-conscious traditions. And I don't, you know, we've got to be more self-conscious about our tradition. So it's interesting. But let me go back to the Pietism thing, since it sort of raised its head here. It is interesting. I mean, the conflict between the Christ who is for us, who is outside of us, and the Christ who is inside of us, and the tensions between Orthodoxy and Pietism. And what I find that's so fascinating in Luther's understanding of this garland woven of four strands is that the strands that led to Orthodoxy are in there, as well as the strands that led to Pietism. For instance, the instruction is there. That's the first piece. But so also is confession and thanksgiving and prayer. And it's as if the tradition, this sort of strand that was Luther wanted to hold together, kind of got unraveled. And the subjective and the objective sides got split apart. But I see the subjective and objective held together rather tightly in his understanding of this fourfold way of praying. Look for instruction. Look for be thankful. Confess. And offer God intercession. I find that really fascinating. It's as if things unravel, and we've been sort of trying to get the objective and the subjective back together ever since. But it does kind of fascinate me that he tries to hold that together, even in this a simple letter to...
At the risk of anticipating perhaps where you're going to go tomorrow, I'm thinking about what you may have in your mind about the connection between a spiritual direction, a spiritual discipline, and what we do, our behavior, ethics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll yeah, it's fascinating because I mean I think the first connection is that our relationship to God forms and transforms our relationship in the world, and that makes it all the more important to nurture that relationship and to check in on a daily basis with what God is up to in our lives. And then, of course, the task is, how do we live this out in our lives? The other thing is that I think that emphasis on Thanksgiving, thanking God for the goodness that God has given us, thanking God for forgiveness of our sins, allows us to move into the world in a way that Luther describes always at cheerfully, with love and service, with gratitude, it affects the way we face the world. Our relationship to God sort of disposes us toward the neighbor in certain ways that are liberating.
Well, I guess I'm also playing in the background the comment about I don't feel the need for this kind of pedantic work in my life. And your striking sense that this is crucial to how we learn what we are to do with God's direction.
And the word pedantic meaning the pedantry of the spiritual.
Yeah, the repetitiveness.
Repetitiveness. Yeah.
This sounds like a lot of work, and I'm not trying to work my way to heaven. And so, why would anybody want to do this?
Why would you not want to check in with God on a daily basis? Why would you not? And you know, there's a structure, but it's a rather flexible structure. And if we believe that God is concerned with what goes on in the world, if we believe that God is an incarnational God, if we believe that God is present in the sufferings and joys of the world, why wouldn't we want to be in contact with God on a fairly regular basis for some kind of insight and help in what is going on in the world in which we live? That sounds really simple.
I wonder whether you could put that question in another context. Why is it necessary for a child to hear constantly from Mom and Dad, I love you? There's a sense in which we as children of God need to hear Him tell us that regularly. Mm-hmm. And we know what happens in normal life when Mom and Dad don't do it. We've got a generation of kids growing up that haven't had that kind of daily contact.
Perhaps it's possible without the structure, the discipline, the instruction, without hiring a spiritual director. Perhaps it's okay just to pray. Regularly, constantly.
Yeah.
I guess some people can't do that. There's no need to be...
But I think that's what she's talking about, praying regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is what I'm talking about.
But on the other hand, why not? What are we missing?
Yeah.
I have found a spiritual director to be of enormous benefit to me.
I'm sure it's great for folks, but not everybody.
You know, first of all, I don't hire him. He's an Episcopal priest, and we share time together. Mm-hmm. And as far as the collegiality among pastors of other churches, I think that's one service we can offer one another.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet once a month for an hour. No big deal. But it is of enormous benefit. And I suspect that if you were able to do it for 6 months, you might find helpful.
I'm not hearing Marty talk about Judas Red. Are you describing what he's talking about?
Well, no, but it works for him.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about is what...
I'm not saying everybody has to do it my way either. I'm just saying, why do we recommend this as an across the board?
Oh, I'm not kind of recommending it. I think it's there as a resource, and it's clearly a resource that's been really helpful to Stuart. But the notion of daily prayer on a regular basis, and sometimes it's helpful to have a format, because sometimes the well is dry. And, sometimes you just sort of show up, and nothing seems to be going on. And nothing amazing happens. And it's not always a mountaintop experience, but at least you show up. But what a spiritual director does, and who knows? I mean, there's nothing in the stuff that I've been working with that recommends that. But for all I know, Luther functioned as Master Peter's spiritual director, and possibly vice versa.
Didn't Luther have a spiritual director himself?
I don't know, but
he did.
At 5 o'clock, at 5 o'clock, the card games came out and the beer got drunk and a lot of stuff got talked about. I mean, when we imagine the mutual conversation and consolation, that's critical in this whole process, mm-hmm. And that's the sort of checking. You check in with God, and then you need to check in with somebody else. Talk about that. I don't know that Luther had a spiritual director.
I think
he
did. I do not recall the name, but yeah. I'm 90% sure he did. Maybe somebody else knows.
Stuff it's for his confessions.
Richard Foster also quotes in one of his books Luther saying something to the effect that he was so busy, if he didn't pray 3 hours a day, he'd never get everything done that he needed to get done. I don't know the source of that, except that Richard Foster writes it.
Very compartmentalized lives. Very compartmentalized lives. I get some people need it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
I think we're dealing here with as much of different personality types as anything else in terms of that style fits, best. But.
Mm-hmm. One reason we need it, and I have used a spiritual director, is because I was plopped in a place where no one knew me, and I knew no one. And that was more than a friend. And it was nice being prayed for and to hear that. And I do not think I would have gotten through the last 3 years if I had had that help. The other thing is, I think that we need to be specific about praying, because there's so many other things demanding our time, that it doesn't, even if God is present, all the time and with us always, we aren't acknowledging it, because there's so many other things that we have to do. Unless we're systematic, it doesn't happen. And there's so many, so much news, so much media happening to us, that we have to shut it down, or we're bombarded all the time.
Yeah.
I'm glad to see that we're talking about it, and I'm glad to hear your presentation, Marty, but part of me is saying to find a Lutheran spirituality isn't going to work. And one of the beauties of say, much of Catholicism, and how that has been tied in with Myers-Briggs in saying that there's different styles of spirituality and different styles of prayer, and they don't fit everybody. And I guess maybe we're only in the beginning stages of figuring out what Lutheran prayer life should be like, or are there different styles to fit different people? Maybe we're not far enough along that we've figured that out. I don't know, but I can kind of relate to down here. If I have to do it in this particular way, that list number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and this is what I do each time, I'm not sure that's what I'll do.
That's a point well taken, and I think that's interesting. One would hope for rich and varied, traditions. And I certainly wasn't trying to suggest one, but I was just trying to suggest contours.
Right.
I think I did
right.
say for a Lutheran spirituality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what might that look like? And certainly Luther allows for a lot of flexibility
right.
and a lot of, if this doesn't work, move on for something else. Or if this is really rich, stay here. Don't move. So, I don't think he'd care if you didn't get past the first commandment or the first petition of the Lord's Prayer. If that's rich, stay there. If it's not, move on. If you want to start somewhere else, start somewhere else. I think the point is, show up.
I guess what I heard you say through all of that, simply that this is an area of our life that has been neglected. And that it is just time to kind of return to some of the piety of the past, hopefully without
mm-hmm.
some of the negative stuff that went with it, return to some of the stuff. But I think it has been definitely
mm-hmm.
I didn't hear you saying that everybody that this is the way we mm-hmm. need to do it, but rather this is a way.
Yeah. Well, or these are just Luther's suggestions.
In one case.
In one case, yeah. Let's see
yeah.
what...
But I mean, that doesn't tell me that everybody has to do it.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't say that, but I didn't think she said that either.
And that what part of the neglect is that we have neglected talking about what we do already
yeah.
do with one
mm-hmm.
another. Again, this consolation of sisters and brothers that we want to go to text study, there's seldom any talk about the prayer life of the individual people at text study. Even though there might be all kinds of conversation related to this.
But it's
not—it's
never
so,
a personal relationship.
Right. No, so, that,
yeah.
so finding out how you do your prayers
mm-hmm.
would be very interesting to me. And certainly it is to me finding out how Mari is
mm-hmm.
going on. So getting that into the open so we are helping one another in the diversified prayer life would be exciting.
I was going to say, or how you are doing in your life of faith.
Sure, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And not doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, for premarital counseling, I'm often tempted to, I don't do this because I'm not ordained, but I sort of challenge people who have to do it. It's easy for me. But prayer is more intimate than sexuality. I wouldn't be so worried if a couple were sleeping together or not. I'd kind of want to know if they could pray together, though.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would kind of want to know if they thought about that, because that's the long haul kind of stuff. I kind of want to know how many of us can do it with, a partner or a spouse. I'm just intrigued with that because I mean, marriage is really at least a tripod, if not a quadrilateral. I mean, we make all kinds of promises to the other, but also to God. And also to a community. And it would be nice to check in once in a while with both the God part and the community part. And, how are we doing on these amazing promises? And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the fracture in relationships is because we don't know how to do that. The promises are made and the paths are just not there. So, There's a lot of stuff here that I think we can think about without becoming Schwärmerei again. this was clearly Luther's fear. He was operating against a kind of rampant pietism with some people of his own generation. But on the other hand, he was working with an intense hierarchy where everything was mediated. And you asked for prayers on behalf of, somebody would ask for prayers on behalf of, well, it was just too complicated for words. So he's always got that double edge. he's always got the objective held in tension with the subjective. And I think it's a fruitful dialectic or a fruitful tension that we need to worry about. But I don't know, this stuff is, it's fascinating. How do we pray?
Sweeping the floor.
What?
Sweeping the floor.
And one of the things that I think is true for me is that I've not always been a Lutheran. Mm-hmm. And I don't know a great deal about Luther or Lutheran traditions. And I would imagine there are other people like that. So, you know, I have a sense of longing for someone giving me instruction. Mm-hmm. And what you were saying this morning was just, I wanted it. And that's what I got. Mm-hmm. And maybe one would move on from that. Mm-hmm. But somehow to have that kind of a discipline, mm-hmm. which I don't have, I would hope that I live my life as prayer, mm-hmm. I go out to the world and do that. Mm-hmm. But I like structure. My mm-hmm. job, when I worked at a job, it was structured. I have an exercise structure in my life. I have things that are structured. But this is not. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like sort of a gap. Mm-hmm. And I think for pastors, you all are so grounded and all of this is second nature to you. Mm-hmm. And it is not second nature to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the words that you have. Mm-hmm. I don't have the understanding that you have. And yes, there's a lot of stuff out there about spirituality, which I could go out and find somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I would, since I'm in the Lutheran Church, I'd like to know mm-hmm. How to use that tradition mm-hmm. and how to make that work for me. Mm-hmm. And I would sort of like to have some of that structure mm-hmm. and some instruction.
Well, it's nice to know it's not off limits. And that, you know, I think we've been so corporately focused that it's not forbidden to have individual prayer. And I think for clergy folks, it's interesting. I was at the churchwide assembly talking to a bunch of former students, and the question came up, where do you worship? When can you worship? And there was kind of a silence around the table. And this is a clergy couple, and one guy said, the man said, well, I worship when Susan's preaching. But when I'm preaching, it's a loss. And Susan said, well, sometimes I worship when I'm distributing communion and I know these people. I know their life stories. And I know what they've been through, and it's such a privilege to share the sacrament with them, and that is a moment of worship for me. But my sense is, and I'm not a parish pastor, my sense was that it's hard often to worship when you're leading worship. And I think it's all the more, maybe this isn't a common experience, I could have been talking to, you know, three oddballs, but it seems that it's all the more important to, you know, structure that in. If we are going to live our lives as prayer, we do need to pray occasionally. And that, you know, that sort of sets the scene. It's like Susan was saying, we forget.
I think Janine made a very interesting point when she said, I need this. Mm-hmm. And I think as clergy, we need to be sensitive to what parishioners need and how we then can respond to that particular need. And the point you were making a while ago, each personality is different. It's very easy for us as clergy to take a particular viewpoint that we have and think that everybody else has the same. And that makes it very difficult for us to listen sensitively to what other people need mm-hmm. that may not be what we need.
Right. And spiritual direction really is a way of facilitating a person to find that path and
right.
put those resources together for themselves in a way that makes sense mm-hmm. and helps maintain that connection with God and that openness to God.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate having the resource you gave us, and I think that would keep it much easier.
Mm-hmm.
You had talked about the intimacy of prayer and the intimacy of spirituality. Is that one of the problems, that it's vulnerable and we need a safe place?
Yeah.
And safe people to be able to be that open. I think about the seminary and some of the tension of the gatekeepers.
Yeah.
And you dare be open.
Well, it would be tough to have somebody who's, it might be a conflict of interest to have somebody who's voting on your approval be your spiritual director. This could be complicated.
Mm-hmm. And yet in the Catholic seminary, mm-hmm. They have that formation mm-hmm. slash spiritual direction and
they
the
do.
Academic and the certification and everything.
Yeah.
It doesn't work always so smoothly though. Huh?
Yeah.
But in the Catholic Church, you also have a very strong hierarchical system. Mm-hmm. So no matter what's happened between the student and the academic instructor in that Catholic environment, there's still a hierarchy that regulates mm-hmm. all of that behavior. But
yeah, they're not voting on approval, I think, the professors are. But it is a conflict of interest in the sense that they're grading you in this class, and they're your spiritual director over here. Mm-hmm.
And academicians have a real problem of being other than academicians in relationship to students.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's particularly true in the Lutheran Church because we're so ingrained in an intellectual kind of mm-hmm. Viewpoint. Lutheranism has been...
Might even be unfair, you know, to yeah. ask that.
And Lutheranism has been so much a head thing mm-hmm. and not a heart thing. And then you add to that the role of the academician, which is the intellectual
mm-hmm.
head thing all the way through.
But I didn't see it stop at the end of the seminary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much trust level is there
mm-hmm.
in the clergy?
Mm-hmm.
I can say from my own experience that I found high trust levels in small group settings.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a new place now, just 2 months, and I've already connected with a group of pastors from other denominational churches, and we are praying regularly on Tuesday mornings. That was going before I got there, but it was a real easy connection for me to make, and it's a very safe place. It's a wonderful place to plug into.
Mm-hmm.